Hey, welcome to a special edition of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode, we are looking back on the life of Jeff Krosnoff, IndyCar driver killed 20 years ago today, July 14th, 1996. The Toronto race, corner worker Gary Avrin, volunteer, was killed as well. Just as much of the tragedy as Jeff's loss. I was trying to think of ways to bring something new to Jeff's memory. And so I reached out to a bunch of good folks. Tommy Kendall being one of them, who grew up with Jeff, essentially best friends, who grew up as kids on the same block, went to racing school, went on to stardom of his own right, sports cars, spoke with Johnny O'Connell, multiple-time champion and everything, who raced against Jeff and kind of, I don't know if I want to say grew up, but at least in terms of the sport, came up the ladder at the same time, racing with Jeff, and he shared some really great stuff about him. Spoke with PJ Jones, who was a part of the Toyota IndyCar family when Toyota came in to IndyCar in 1996. He's driving for Dan Gurney's team, so he and Jeff were stable mates. Also a Southern California guy like Jeff. Shared some great thoughts about him. Spoke with a couple more California guys. Brian Herta, who grew up in Southern California, raced IndyCars. Jeff came over, got the call from Mike Holt, Chip Ganassi Racing, to do a shootout for the seat that they took Brian out of. Asked him about that. A little bit of an awkward thing, but Brian, who's just a good dude, happy to speak about that, and also was very open about Jeff's influence on him. Also spoke with Jimmy Vassar, who, would have been Jeff's teammate had Jeff been hired by the Ganassi team, but raced against him. Also, like many of the others, grew up with or around Jeff, raced against him in the formative series, and then again in IndyCar. Spoke with my friend John Hindoff from Radio Le Mans, who was there in 1994, the year where Jeff really came to international acclaim for his drive with Toyota. John shared his thoughts about what it was like calling that, meeting Jeff, seeing that. So a lot of who we spoke with, Americans, folks who grew up racing with him early and in his final season. It's great to have Hindy on to talk about Jeff's impact across the pond. And then also spoke with Jeff's sister Karen. Spoke with his other sister Tanya 5 years ago when we did the Stay Hungry feature. And this is the first time speaking with Karen, and she shared some great stuff as usual. So all these folks, pretty amazing, very generous. I think probably 50 minutes altogether of what I've edited down from our various conversations, just to bring some sound to Jeff, to go among all the words that are out there. As I've said and written many, many times, he was a huge influence on me, big inspiration. It's no secret that I'm a guy that is always rooting for the underdog, the blue-collar racer, and he ticked all those boxes, was fast as hell, cut down in his prime, which is just brutal. But, you know, the story doesn't always end the way we want it for him, or for Gary Avrin, but here we are 20 years later, still stinging a bit from their loss. Don't anticipate that's going to go away anytime soon, just like many of us continue to mourn Dan Weldon, Justin Wilson, Sean Edwards, just on and on. But this is Jeff's anniversary, Gary's anniversary, and so off we go, starting with Tommy, and I'll introduce the rest of the speakers as they come in.
His legacy really is kind of, he's the guy that taught me what it meant to be a serious race car driver, and there was no blueprint for that. I mean, I was just lucky that I happened to live down the street from him and was introduced kind of to it through him. And so, you know, now there is a blueprint for what it takes to be a serious racer. You need to be in shape, you need to study the craft, you need to understand the car, you basically need to leave no stone unturned, you need to get to know the team, you need to get to know how the team works. He kind of did that before anyone knew to do that. And so I was lucky. I mean, I was seen as being that guy, sort of the prototypical young driver. But I learned it from him. You know, he went off to Europe, and I just, you know, it's a combination. My dad was that way also, just in terms of his approach when he played football and such. But Jeff showed me what it meant in the race world. And so, I mean, you know, didn't touch alcohol, fitness fanatic, you know, it just thinking of new ways to test himself. So, and just reading everything he get his hands on, talking to he really, and then that sort of emanated to, you know, slowly, you know, everyone's that way on both sides of the pond. But I really think he, you know, did a lot to be at the very, very forefront of that. So whether they realize it or not, he's sort of the blueprint. The young guys coming up today, I guess.
Along with TK, Johnny O'Connell went to the same driving school that helped launch so many of the stars that reached IndyCar in the 80s and 90s, and it was pretty awesome to hear him break down what it was like going up against a young Jeff Krosnoff.
You know, I actually, you know, I went to the Russell School in 1983, and then actually won a scholarship. They had a scholarship program back there where, you know, out of 56 guys, whoever, you know, was fastest, I got a free year of racing with them. And that's what put me out in California. I won that scholarship, which was really my only chance at having a career. And that first year, you know, you show up and you're like meeting all these guys, and you find out real quick who are the fast guys. And the fast guy, the regular fast guy, was always the guy that beat was Jeff. He was extremely well put together in every sense of the word. His professionalism, you know, about racing. But, I mean, he just always dressed perfectly, with perfect hair. And he had this, I think it was a black Firebird, a Camaro, that was like, I was totally jealous. Because I was like, I think I was driving a station wagon that was supplied to me by the Gallo Wine Company. But you know what? I mean, it's funny because, you know, we raced together, you know, in the school series in 84 and 85. In 86, we raced in the pro series together. And that year, he was teamed with a guy named Ken Twakes. And they were sponsored by Harvey's Casino. And I think everybody, you know, certainly on the West Coast, you know, knew Jeff as one of the super fast guys. And when I think back to that time in my life, you know, a week before the race, you know, you'd have it in your head. And there was only one guy you really ever worried about, and that was Jeff. Wow. You know, how fast was Jeff going to be? In 87, we competed against each other in the Atlantic Series. That was kind of a breakout year for me. But I, you know what, one of my favorite pictures that I have in my collection is I won the race in Spokane, but Jeff was second. And so, like, you know, having a picture of the two of us was pretty special. But, you know, again, going back to where you're saying how well put together Jeff was, you know, when I look at what, if I were to make a fair comparison between the two of us, I would say he was much better back then at the building the interpersonal relationships and understanding the business side of racing. I know, and again, this is, you know, my vision from the outside. You know, he and Paul Fanner were very good friends, and I don't know how Jeff, you know, negotiated things, but I know that, you know, he got involved in racing the SCCA pickup truck series.
Yep.
Which, you know, you wouldn't think would be a springboard to great things, but for him, it became a great thing because, again, it gave him a wider platform, you know, not just nationally, but, you know, it wound up being internationally because it might have been around 88 or 89 when he just took off to Japan to race, you know, Formula 3000. And, you know, again, he must have, it's like he had the internet before everybody else did. Because, you know, I certainly didn't know much of what was going on in racing in Japan at the time. And he went over there and you know, established himself as one of the fast guys, you know, teammates like Eddie Irvine. And I know he raced against Ross Cheever, a lot of guys who in that era, you know, were big names in racing. You know, racing in Japan at the time, they were paying big money for those guys. But that transition to leave home, to race, you know, and you talk about a foreign country, you know, that's quite the culture shock. But then established himself over there. And I remember, you know, when my early Nissan days, when I was, you know, testing the GTP and Group C stuff, all the guys from Nismo, everybody knew about Jeff.
Yeah.
And was respected. And so his career really started taking off. And it was a very cool thing for me, because in 94, that was the first year I ever competed at Le Mans, and Jeff was there. And Jeff was in one of the factory Toyotas. And I think he was actually teamed with Eddie Irvine.
Yeah, he was. He almost won the thing.
And actually, you know, go back to, it might have been 93 or 94, and Toyota showed up at the 24 Hours of Daytona, the Japanese team, with a Group C, I can't remember if it was a Group C or prototype, but I was running the Nissan GTO, and they had an issue early on, but then to see those guys fight back, I mean, it was memorable. Well, you know, you going into the old bus stop chicane, and how fast those guys were going compared to any of the other prototypes, and just, you know, thinking, man, you know, Jeff's got himself a pretty good gig. But I remember at Le Mans that year, and like, you know, talking with him and Eddie Irvine, you know, and I think that was Jeff's first Le Mans as well. And so, you know, when you're a rookie at Le Mans, you're overcome with the excitement, and it was just very cool to see a guy that, you know, I started out with, and here we are both with factories, and we're at the biggest race in the world. But you know what? It was, I think you could see, you know, I think a lot of people learned about Jeff that race, because they were fighting, they're having a great battle, and then he had a gearbox issue with his car right on the front straightaway. And so I remember watching video of Jeff getting out of the car, going around to the back to try to manually get the car into gear and get it back to the pits. So, you know, he was an unbelievably, you know, talented guy. I think the thing that, you know, it's a shame that most people in racing that didn't know Jeff is what a special person he was.
Yeah.
You know, he had a very sharp, quick, sometimes dry sense of humor, and just, you know, was, you know, I think we all, you know, if you've been around motorsports, you run across drivers that might come across as being arrogant or full of themselves, but Jeff was never that. He was just a competent, you know, race car driver who was 100% always committed, you know, when he was in the car.
And my dear friend John Hindoff was able to call Jeff's races at Le Mans 1994 being the one that stands out for everyone. And as usual, Hindy brings us inside that event and Jeff's breakout performance in a way that few could.
And first of all, Marshall, I think, like everyone else will say, I can't believe it's 20 years.
Yeah.
In some ways, it feels a lot closer than that. It's funny, actually, because Jeff's name came up to me in conversation with someone who I came to call as a friend and trust their judgment on people and particularly drivers very much. In 1991, Jeff went to Le Mans for the first time and raced with the TWR Jaguar. I wasn't there in 1991. That was the Mazda year. I was having chicken pox at home and didn't get there. But he raced with David Leslie. And the also late lamented David became a good friend of mine in the 80 years. And I remember interviewing David, it might have been 92 or 93, and asking him that car didn't finish the race, actually, and I think it barely got to halfway. And I remember interviewing David about that effort. It would probably have been 1992 for that year's Le Mans, which I was back at. And David spoke very highly of Jeff Krosnoff and how he was as a teammate and as a person and an individual. I didn't get to meet him until 1994 when Jeff was back at Le Mans again with Mauro Martini, and it should have been, of course, with Roland Ratzenberger, but sadly Roland had lost his life earlier on that year, although Roland's name was left on the car at the insistence of the other drivers. Eddie Irvine was brought in to drive that Toyota. It was the Saab entry. And actually finished first in class and second overall, and that not without some drama, in fairness, which we'll come to in a moment. But my memory of meeting Jeff early on in that week was a very approachable person who was still taking it all in. It was his second Le Mans, not his first, but he was still, like many drivers doing, drinking in the atmosphere. And in some ways, that was what endeared him to me, because I've always been a fan of Le Mans, and I always slightly worry about people who take them on in their stride and get blasé about it, because I don't think it matters how many times you've been there. It should move you. It should make a difference. And certainly that was the case with Jeff. And just the chats that we had early in the week would indicate that definitely. He was very excited about that year, but that was tinged obviously with a sadness that Roland wasn't going to be in the car. But Eddie Irvine was drafted in at the last minute, a horrible job for him to have to do, but did a pretty good job. But I remember that car coasting to a halt just on the pit lane, actually. Not desperately different from this year's Toyota coasting to a halt, and almost in the same place as well when I think back to it now. My goodness, what
brutal. Just what, brutal.
Just come back to my mind. It was out of gears, and Jeff being Jeff refused to allow that to stop him. Somehow used something that was in the car, a screwdriver or whatever, and jammed it into third gear, got the car back to the pits. The car was subsequently fixed and went on to win its class. Remarkable piece of clever thinking by a man who always thought out of the box and was very much more than just a racing driver and just the results that his desperately short and tragically short career would suggest. He was back the next year, but in a GT1 car. It was another Toyota, of course, but another Saad entry with Mauro Martini. In fact, his 3 years at Le Mans in 91, 94, 95, Mauro Martini was a constant.
Yeah.
And Marco Apicella was his teammate there. So it was the two Italians who were, you know, particularly Italian as well, those two. Always up for fun, always up for a joke. And Jeff fit into that very, very well. He was very relaxed away from the track, but very focused and serious when he was behind the wheel. And again, that year, I remember talking to him. That Toyota Supra was a fantastic piece of kit. I came home in 8th in class and 14th. I've had to look that up. I couldn't remember that, if I'm honest. But I just remember looking at the thing. The thing was a beast. And after the win in class for the previous year, you might have thought that going down to a GT1 car for 1995 would have upset Jeff a bit. Nothing apart from it. If you told him he was racing a Mini Cooper at the back of the field for Le Mans in 1995, he'd have been very happy to do so. And if you'd pointed out, but you've never raced a front-wheel drive car before, then he would have said, yeah, but I'll get on with it. And he would get on with it. That was the thing. We made a lot of fuss, didn't we, this year at Le Mans about IndyCar drivers coming over and being GT drivers and racing in the race. Well, you know, Jeff was the prototype for that. He was somebody who would, you got the feeling, would race anything. He talked very confidently about other areas of the sport, something else that I know you know that really touches me. He clearly wasn't blinkered what Jeremy Shaw, who's sitting not too far away from me, would call a student of the sport. And it was absolutely, that was a perfect description for him. An all-rounder, an all-round nice bloke, as well as a damn fine racing driver. Unfortunately, I also remember the day he died, Marshall, because I was working at the British Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And we had been, I'd done the breakfast show and then stayed on for the race and done some more broadcasting. And at the end of the day, we'd all decanted over to the press centre and were sitting there with various other journalists who'd filed their Formula One stories, and we were sitting there watching the IndyCar race, which in those days you could see live on various satellite TV outlets in the UK. And the moment that accident happened was one of those times when it doesn't matter whether you're in a room or out of it, if you're at a track, the whole track held its breath at that point, and the press room held its breath, and it might as well have happened right outside the door for us. I can't imagine what it was like for you guys who were actually at the track, but because we were in such a big crowd of motorsport journalists, it somehow seemed to transport us as if we were watching the event at the track in front of us, and everybody just went silent, and everybody had that horrible feeling that it wasn't going to be good news. And of course it wasn't. I try not to think of that day. I try to think of the days at Le Mans in 1994, particularly when I first met him in 1995, when he came back, when he was smiling and running around cracking jokes with Marco Apicella and Mauro Martini, because that was the sort of guy he was, just an all-round good bloke. And, you know, the the biggest compliment I can pay Jeff, and this might not mean a lot to a lot of people, but hopefully it will to people who know me, is to tell you what David Leslie told me about him. And, you know, David Leslie, there's another driver who would have driven anything, and he could have had that motto as well, Marshall, to be honest. And when I was asking David about him in 1992, and these words stuck with me when 1994 came around and I got to interview and meet Jeff, I said, so, you know, what were your teammates like? Mauro Martini, obviously, I'd come across before, but not Jeff. And he said, oh, no, Jeff, proper bloke, proper driver. Mm. And if David Leslie said that, you know, that stuck with me. And if David Leslie said that, that's all the praise and all the comment I need to leave you with on Jeff Krosnoff and the impact that he made on people's lives.
1996 CART IndyCar Series champion Jimmy Vassar raced against Jeff. Knew Jeff fairly well. Two of them grown up in California, coming up at essentially the same time. Shared his thoughts on what it was like as a young buck who was, I think, expecting to move up to IndyCar with Jeff at some point in time, and just what he thought about Jeff veering off into the very different and completely unique path of rerouting his career to Japan after his attempts to move up the ladder here in America stalled.
Well, you didn't think that deeply about it, you know. Everybody just thought, well, shit, he's getting paid, he's making good money. Look at Jeff, he's making good money in Japan, and everybody at that time was just trying to make some money, you know, or get to the next level or get to be a professional, you know. Finding rides in Atlantic or Super V or ARS or Indy Lights, whatever you want to call it, or get a ride, you know, at IMSA, and get paid. You know, getting paid was like, you know, that was the next step. You know, obviously everybody wants to be in the F1 or IndyCar. Not so much people in the NASCAR back then, but now it would be NASCAR. And then with those spoils, you know, comes getting paid. But I think he went there to get paid. He went there thinking maybe that was a path to F1. He went there because that's where their opportunity was. He had some opportunity. He went over. He showed well. You know, the Japanese wheel company, Speedstar, was over there. I know he met those guys, and they helped him get some sponsorship going with the Formula 3000 over there. And he was working. You know, and then that small, you've seen a lot of the stories with the small niche of, you know, European guys or guys from elsewhere. You know, they lived in hotels in Tokyo and kind of commiserated together and tried to make a life out of it.
Brian Herta was another young open wheeler who shot out of Southern California and was someone who had a very impressive young career, winning championships, graduated to IndyCar in 1994 with A.J. Foyt. Had a big crash that year, though. Broke some bones, ended the season prematurely, and his entry in 95 with a different team happened to be his debut with Chip Ganassi Racing. And despite setting pole at Phoenix and I think impressing me, did not earn a return back for his second year with Chip. And when Chip decided to look elsewhere as a partner for Jimmy Vassar, Jeff was one of the candidates. Interesting to speak with Brian about what it was like, effectively having someone that he really admired, who he monitored from afar in Japan, having him come over, and you know, his seat was already gone, but having someone he admired come over and try and get his first shot in IndyCar by replacing him.
I guess it was my real introduction into the business or big time motor racing, because, you know, I came up through the Skip Barber series and then did Indy Lights with Brian Stewart and then with Tasman, which were both kind of very family environment, small teams. And then, you know, I drove for AJ, which again kind of had that same kind of small team family vibe.
Sure.
But yeah, when I went to drive for Chip, it was obviously a big break for me, but it came with a lot of, and I was coming off, you know, I'd broken my pelvis in 7 places and my femur the previous year. And so it's probably a miracle that Chip hired me at all coming out of that. And to be honest, I wasn't really right for most of that year. I mean, I was still healing. I still had a lot of pain in the car. If I did anything wrong, you know, I was afraid to say I was hurt. Mm. I was afraid to say I was hurting because I still had a metal rod and 13 screws in my leg and a plate. I was afraid that if I said I was hurting, that they would just take me out of the car, which, you know, you get older and smarter and you realize that wasn't the right thing. The smarter thing would have been. So I kept it to myself. I didn't tell anybody.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they knew on some level because I get out of the car, I was limping badly sometimes. But I tried my best to hide it, to keep it to myself. I thought that was the right thing to do. And I think it definitely hurt my performances. Yeah, certainly in the races, and qualifying less so. But, you know, in the races, especially the street courses where you really had to lean on the brake pedal, and some of the road courses where you had to brake hard, I struggled braking because it was my right femur I'd broken. And I was a right foot breaker. And I hadn't, you know, again, if I had talked to them about what I was struggling with, I think they would have helped me. I think they would have encouraged me to adapt to left foot braking, because that's what I finally did the next year at Ray Hall, is I talked about it. Sure. And we went testing, and I started left foot braking, and within a day or two, I had it down, and I was a left foot breaker from then on. So there was... Yeah, I was young, and, you know, I just didn't handle things right. And by the end of the year, I think Chip lost confidence. Even though I had a deal for the following year, I think Chip just lost his heart. What he says, my heart's not in it. You know, he had lost confidence. And, you know, as a driver, you don't want to be somewhere where you don't feel wanted.
Sure.
So the handwriting was on the wall. So by the time, you know, we get to towards the off season and... You know, yeah, they were going testing with other drivers, trying to figure out who they're going to put in the car. It's never a pleasant feeling, but at that stage, I already knew it wasn't going to be me. So, you know, there was never, I didn't have any animosity towards the other drivers. You know, like as a driver, you're kind of simpatico. You understand, you know, they're trying to get a ride and trying to be in the best car, just like you are. It's kind of goes with the territory. You're always competing for seats. There's only so many.
Did you guys, knowing that you had some light affiliation from Southern California, do you guys get a chance to speak at all, or you know, run wheel to wheel at all? Just curious.
Well, we didn't. We never talked about the Ganassi test, or I guess that kind of intersection. You know, it's funny. My recollections. I was always kind of fascinated with Jeff, because I. You know, he was a contemporary of mine, being a Southern California guy. And I was really, you know, what I remember is he went off to Japan and was racing. You know, so I was reading about him in On Track magazine and what he's doing, and it just seemed kind of so exotic to me, because I was, you know, I'd never been out of the U.S. basically,
yeah.
And the idea of racing overseas or moving to Japan and racing, and he was racing. You know, it seemed like he was racing in that Formula Nippon series, which is sort of the equivalent of GP2 now-ish. And then he was, you know, then the next week he'd be in a, you know, some kind of a GT car over there. And then the week after that he was in a full-on Le Mans prototype. And you know, the amount of experience and the success he was having over there as an American, you know, I remember reading about all the kind of expat drivers that were over there living, they all lived in a hotel together, took trains to the track, and it was kind of fascinating to me. And so when he came here and raced, you know, those were the kinds of things that we talked about. I was really interested in his experiences with those kinds of things, and what it was like being over there and racing over there and living abroad and all that. It was really interesting to me.
Like Jeff, Johnny O'Connell went quite far coming up the open wheel ladder, and then when things stalled out, had to take a bit of a different path. Ended up spending almost the majority of the rest of his career, which is still active, in sports cars, but he did get a chance with the formation of the Indy Racing League in the mid-90s to log a couple of IndyCar starts of his own. But at least for that period when Jeff came over, Johnny admits to a bit of envy.
Well, you know, at that time in my career, if I'm honest with you, I was jealous. You know, he got an amazing opportunity there, and that was actually around the time when my Nissan had gotten out of sports cars and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I think Jeff would admit to probably always wanting to be a little bit competitive
with me, and I was competitive with him. But then, you know, once he got that car, you know, once he got the ride with Cal Wells, he made that his team. You know, and in a very short amount of time, he became the face of Toyota and IndyCar. And you got to give him a ton of credit for that. And, you know, that car, you know, they shouldn't have even been close as they were. And I think Jeff was, you know, really, you know, positioning himself to be one of the superstars of IndyCar. You know, I mean, he was gifted.
PJ Jones, I actually got to know Jeff quite early and raced against him in the SCCA Super Truck Series. And again, as a competitor in CART, but also as part of the Toyota family. So he was kind enough to share some thoughts about that really hard day 20 years ago where, you know, the proverbial music stopped. Everything absolutely stopped. Everything absolutely fell silent over Toronto. And as someone racing, someone competing against Jeff, PJ shared his thoughts about what it was like. And also, he became very close friends with Greg Moore, or was becoming close friends with Greg Moore not too long after, and gave some thoughts about that as well. Brian Herta was competing in the race at Toronto and brought us inside what he was experiencing. And Jimmy Vassar also spoke a little bit about what it was like reconnecting with Jeff and then unfortunately going to his funeral so soon after. So the three of those guys just speak one after the other.
The first time that I met Jeff was racing in the SCCA Truck Series.
Yeah, the race trucks.
Yeah, the race trucks. I went over there and did a couple with Straub and with Ford and Bill Straub. And, you know, I think, you know, they had a pretty good, strong program. And the first time that I really, you know, kind of got to know him, we were doing all this Toyota stuff, you know, at the start of the IndyCar program with Toyota. And obviously, you know, we were in different teams, but we were teammates in the sense that we were all factory Toyota drivers.
Yeah.
Him being with Cal Wells, me being with Gurney, and we were doing a lot of things together. A little bit of competition between the two teams, mainly between the two car owners than it was with the drivers.
Sure.
But, I mean, he was solid and just an all-around great guy. And, you know, I remember clear as day. And I got there probably just as he stopped sliding, you know, as the accident kind of just came to an end. And, man, I at that point really didn't know who it was because I don't really think that there was a piece bigger than a, you know, a large size cardboard box, you know, left of anything. I mean, it was just such a, you know, you knew that it wasn't a good situation, but man, it was tough. I mean, that was a tough day for us because, I mean, that's just somebody young, you know, had a great career in front of him. And somebody I was just getting acquainted with. But always had a smile on his face. Loved what he was doing. Every time I go down there, and every time I run around there, or go there, I always think of it. I mean, it's something that, you know, kind of always stuck in our mind. And I remember, you know, just standing out the back of the truck after that all happened, and Greg Moore's accident. You know, I had just spent 2 weeks, or I just spent like a week before that. We did him and I. And we were just getting to really know each other, and so for some reason, we said, "Hey, let's go to Vegas together." And so we rented some big suite, and with our girlfriends, and we spent like 4 or 5 days together in Las Vegas.
Wow.
Greg and I, and you know, the next week was Fontana, and those two. I think those two more than anything else in IndyCar kind of really affected me because obviously they were my age, they're up and coming. Just you know, kind of really sucked.
I didn't see the crash at the time,
they pretty quickly went red flag. They stopped us all at basically at the head of that straightaway.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember they stopped us. We all got out of the cars. I remember who I was standing with. I remember I was standing with Paul Tracy and Adrian Fernandez, and we were, you know, basically chatting and, you know, kind of nervously saying, you know, although none of us knew exactly what had happened, that, you know, we could tell by the way the race was stopped, the urgency of the whole thing, we knew something wasn't good, right? Something wasn't, you know, the way it was happening, the urgency of the whole thing, we knew it wasn't a good situation. And so, but the thing I remember is, I think Paul and Adrian and I were chatting, but not about the accident. You know, I think you tend, as drivers, you got to kind of block it, because we didn't know, A, what had happened, and B, if we were going to have to get back in and finish the race. And so I think knowing that that's possible, you tend to kind of put a mental block up at the time, right? And you really can't process anything traumatic like that. You have to kind of just push it back, push it down, because you may be getting back in and going and finishing your race, and you need to be able to do that mentally, emotionally. You know, obviously, they didn't restart the race, and I remember being in a paddock after. It was just kind of a somber feeling. At the time, we weren't getting information. It took a while before anybody really knew, you know, what had happened, you know, that he had passed. And so it's kind of a weird time where, you know, you're nervous and you're hoping for some kind of good news, but it just doesn't feel like that's really what's going to be coming.
And it was cool. We hung out. When he got the ride for Cal and came in 96, it was cool. But, you know, I was kind of so busy with starting the season out with the wins and chasing the championship, and they were struggling. We didn't get to hang out much. You know, We were on two different paths, and then obviously what happened in, you know, halfway through the season was just, you know, it was just shit. So, I went to his funeral, I remember, that was just, you know, there must have been thousands of people there.
Jesus.
It was outdoor, it was a beautiful service, and a lot of guys got up and said great words, and, you know, it was a great service.
Tommy Kendall has been absolutely tireless in keeping Jeff's memory alive over the past 20 years. He's helped me on many occasions to come up with something new and interesting to share about Jeff on this July 14th anniversary. When we spoke a week or two ago trying to think of what would be best for the 20th, he shared a pretty interesting thing that he was able to take part in not too long ago. And he said he saved that just for us. So, as usual, Tommy Kendall, one of the finer examples of a human being.
Yeah, I got to go up to the Krosnoff house. His mom died relatively recently. And so his sisters were, you know, they were doing an estate sale. And Tanya invited me up and to go through his room. And it was hard, but it was also nice. You know, it was really as he left it. I mean, he left his room kind of that way, and the whole house is a bit of a time capsule, but yeah, I went in the room, and there was just, I mean, just with typical Jeff, everything was categorized and organized. I mean, from just stickers from when we ran the Harvey's racing team, and I got some of those, and I just spent a lot of time just sitting in there, models, and just model boxes that he had cut and turned into boards, and, you know, he just created his own surroundings. It was just immersive racing, you know. And she said I could take whatever I wanted, so I wanted to take it all. But I ended up taking a stack of On Track magazines, you know, with his address label on them. And I the thing that I the coolest little piece I took was, it was 5x7 of every single F1 car coming up over Linden and Long Beach. I think it was in probably 78 or 79.
Wow.
And so Villeneuve, and it was the exact same shot of every single car. Villeneuve was the most spectacular, of course. And he had them all mounted there. not only was it a cool collage of racing at Long Beach in the early days of F1, it was through the lens of Jeff Krosnow. And so so that's my kind of cool keepsake. And so it was weird to say goodbye. You know, I went into the room where we used to watch all the races back in the early days of satellite. Dr. Kros was, that was his thing. And so he had one of those massive dishes, and so we could get all the different halls. And we had one too, but we could never find all the back halls and the the feeds with no commercials. So I'd go up there and let Dr. Kros sort that out. We'd watch all the races together in that room in the big Easy Boys. And so I went in there, and, you know, it was just a trip down memory lane.
I'd be lying if I said it was easy to ask Jeff's sister Tanya 5 years ago about dealing with his prolonged absence. And it was no different speaking with his sister Karen for the first time this week. 20 years, definitely hard. I mean, for those of us on the outside, my voice, every other voice you've heard so far, they're from people that knew him, revered him, were good friends, competitors, but they didn't happen to carry the last name Krosnow. So, in, I guess, what you would expect from a Krosnow, Karen is honest, funny, engaging, real. Also shares a bit with us about how she has tried to bring some of her brother's ways and means and character into raising her own family. So, just beyond thankful to have one of the Krosnoffs help remember Jeff.
There's so many things that come to mind, only because, you know, he was my brother. But then I think back and I look at this picture of him and his mini bike, and I remember days when we were, you know, what we used to call down back, and my parents, they had a like an acre lot that he used to ride the dirt bike on, and I had ponies, and he would make these big ramps, and my dad would get dirt from construction sites in the area, dump these big dump, you know, piles of dirt in the back, and he'd make tunnels for my ponies to run through while he would jump over it in his mini bike, and just, you know, crazy stuff. So I see some of these photos, and it just, I mean, it all brings so much back, you know, the film taking while he was driving, when he's taking photos in the truck. I mean, he was crazy. That was just who he was. Such a fond memory, and they're always such positive memories. I mean, I can, of course, think of a few that are positive, because he was my brother, and he was a little scoundrel, too. But, everybody always had, all of us kids growing up, it was always fun. It's like it was yesterday, because they're always so positive and warm. Jeff was, a month before he passed, my son was being christened. My sister and I had our children christened together. And when we did that, I asked Jeff if he would be my son Dustin's godfather. And he agreed, of course. And then a month later, he actually became it. I always spoke with my brother, with my kids growing up, because my son was 7 months to the day when Jeff died. I always talked about him. And, I'm sorry, I'm a little hoarse, too, from screaming at my daughter's softball game.
No.
She actually, her jersey number is 14. And, because I talked about Jeff so much when she was growing up, and she would dream of him, and she never met him.
Wow.
So I used to tell her that you met him before you met me. As you were being born, you knew him. Wow. He came and helped you get into the world, and then there I was. But she felt really close and always has.
It's tough hearing Karen obviously go to a place that still hurts quite a bit. Pretty amazing, though, to hear about how much she's continues to try and keep him as a part of the family, as an influence from within. Johnny O'Connell as well, his son Kanan, has
someone that has been the recipient of advice from Dad that also bears the mark of a certain Jeff Krosnoff. So as we wind down our podcast here and head towards some final closing thoughts on Jeff and on the events of July 14th, 1996, here's Johnny O'Connell.
Maybe it's inappropriate for me, but it's a silly way for me to remember Jeff. And that when I do my blogs or post something, about a Cadillac weekend or what's going on with, with my racing, I'll often end, the bit or the story or whatever with, stay hungry or still hungry, And that was, that was Jeff's moniker. Yep. I borrow that, I steal that from Jeff. And hopefully, he's not looking down from heaven too pissed off at me. Hopefully he understands that, it's a sign of remembrance, a sign of respect for what a great, talent that he was, because that was his. I mean, that was his motto, stay hungry, okay? And so maybe three or four guys know that, when they read my stuff, that's just like a reference to Jeff. But, it's a shame, to lose, such an amazing talent that in a brief, 10-year career, basically, 10, 12 years, accomplished so much, achieved so much, and affected so much.
The topic of safety in motor racing has only grown more important every year. IndyCar racing is certainly something that is constantly being addressed these days with the somewhat recent deaths of Dan and Justin, and with Jeff's death, very hard death, very public and demonstrative death, there were somewhat immediate changes and improvements made. If we look back now 20 years, as I asked Brian Herta to do, and to think about the safety standards back then, on the back straight where Jeff and Gary Avern happened to be killed, the fencing was behind the barrier, for example. When Jeff went over the barrier, there was nothing to stop his car from hitting Gary or any of the other corner workers. IndyCar safety itself has continued to improve. We could have aero screens on the way and other things to improve cockpit safety. That, who knows, 20 years ago, if that was in place, would we have lost Jeff, who was struck on top of the cockpit that was open and exposed? These are all the questions to ask as we look back, and Brian, as usual, was able to give a very honest and reasoned account of where we were and where he hopes we go.
Yeah, I think if you had tried 20 years ago, you wouldn't have noticed some of the things that ended up being very important, right? And I think that's still the case, right? I would like to think when we go to Toronto 20 years from now, we'll look back and say, wow, it's amazing how much better it is now.
Mm.
Again, it was was then. I mean, that's always the goal of racing, right? Is we're all about innovation and progress. Most of it is, the exciting stuff is focused around trying to make the car go faster. But you look at the safety innovations and things that have come along in the last 20 years, I think we can be proud of that. And sadly, some of the biggest forward progress comes on the heels of some of the worst outcomes, as we learn from it. The only thing that would be disappointing to me is if we fail to learn from things.
Well, we close with Tommy Kendall, fittingly, I think. As he looks back on 20 years, what it has been like living those 20 without Jeff. But he also contemplates what those 20 years might have been like for Jeff, what he might have been able to achieve. And Tommy closes talking about dealing with loss. This is something that as we celebrate Jeff on this 20th anniversary, unfortunately that celebration is coming from his departure, not from 20 years of sustained victories, championships, and otherwise. So, ever the realist, Tommy closes the show with a bit of reality for us.
On the 20-year anniversary, I got to thinking, a lot of reflection the last year with going into the Hall of Fame, but, carrying that over the 20 years since Jeff, and it was
really think about it, there's no doubt in my mind if he was alive, he would still be racing. He'd be racing at a high level. It's not out of the realm of possibility that he would have been part of the Le Mans program. You know, that's kind of unheard of to have a guy that's 51 or so. But it would not surprise me if he was still racing and would have been part of that Toyota program, given his ties there. You know, it's very possible he'd have a son that would be a phenom like Jos Verstappen's kid, Max. You know, the age would be about right. So, and there's no way of knowing, but it's nothing would surprise me in terms of what he would be doing. He would definitely be, he'd still be driving, probably until, literally until he was 60, you know, at a pretty high level, because he'd be fit and the love of it would never go away. And he'd want to be involved trying to help it as well. So tough, you know, because it's, you know, all lives cut short are tough, but it's one that was so full of potential and enthusiasm and skill and passion, you know, so tough. Unfortunately, that's part of, you know, we lost some really good ones, even in my era, you know, with he and Weldon and Greg Moore, you know, obviously in Jeff's accident. Of course, we, at the same time, we always remember Gary Averin as well. You know, it's, you know, Dan Gurney said it well, I think, when Jeff crashed, you know, just that it pierces sort of the veil. You know, thankfully, the deaths happen much more infrequently now. You know, it underscores what's different about our sport than any other. And, you know, because you could pay the ultimate price, everyone that does it has to kind of face that, confront that. You push it as far away as you can, but whenever you lose someone, it brings it back front and center. And the guys that can do it, whether it's smart or not or what have you, it's you know, it's kind of the ultimate expression of freedom and how you want to live your life. And so I guess you can't have it both ways, and it wouldn't be the same if it was totally safe, or even safe to the point where you can only get hurt. I mean, you can't. It's the other side of the same coin that has all the stuff we love about it. So I know. Doesn't make me feel any better that one of the guys we lost was a guy I grew up with and one of my closest friends, but it's the way it is.
And that was our look back 20 years after the death of Jeff Krosnoff and Gary Averin in Toronto. July 14th. Bastille Day, it's UFC fighter Conor McGregor's birthday. There's a lot of meaning on July 14th for a variety of people around the world. For some of us who were there in Toronto on that day, or knew Jeff, raced against him, happened to have him as a sibling, you name it. I know that it has a particular meaning for a number of us as well. Thanks again to the 7 people that volunteered their time to help speak about Jeff and bring him to life through a podcast. So again, we'll thank Tommy Kendall, Johnny O'Connell, John Hindoff, PJ Jones, Brian Herta, Jimmy Vassar, and Karen Krosnoff for their selflessness. Thanks again for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at marshallpruitt.com.